thanks for joining us. I'm Catty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is on a cruise with public radio listeners. Both the House and Senate expect to begin debate on healthcare legislation this month. The House version, announced last week, has an estimated net cost of $894 billion. Positive GDP news for the third quarter offered some hope for the US economy. But still, many worry just how we'll foot the bill for this massive overhaul. Joining me in the studio to talk about healthcare and its impact on the economy, Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute, Bruce Bartlett, columnist and former Reagan economic policy aide, and by phone from Boston, David Cutler. He's professor at Harvard University and was a senior advisor to the Obama presidential campaign. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, our pleasure, Kenny.
My pleasure.
And we'll be opening the phones later on in the program. The number here is 1-800-433-8850. Our email address is drshow@wmu.org. Please do join us with your questions and comments. Norm, let me start with you. This morning, the Wall Street Journal has an op-ed, and the headline is "The Worst Bill Ever." Are they right?
That fits with a long stream of Wall Street Journal op-eds and editorials. I don't think they're right. This is not the best bill ever. Whether we're talking about the House version or the Senate version, there are a lot of very good things here, things that include providing people with a safety net that hasn't existed before for insurance, creating exchanges that ultimately might provide a fairer marketplace for competition. And I do believe that moving towards an individual mandate where everybody has to be covered, which means a universal risk pool, which means you can't cherry pick as some insurance companies do, or leave out those who are the most vulnerable, or freeze out those with pre-existing conditions, all are very positive things. I wish we could be doing it in a different way and transform the system. And I wish we could find a much better way to use the cliche, bend the cost curve more so that we don't end up with more skyrocketing deficits. But I don't think it's a bad start.
Bruce, not a bad start?
I would pretty much go along with that. Of course, the Wall Street Journal's editorial page is always pure hyperbolic. Everything that happens under the Democrats is the worst of all time, and when the Republicans do the same identical thing, they just get a pass. For example, I myself have said the worst bill ever passed was the Medicare Part D legislation in 2003, because its total cost was pretty much exactly the same as the Obama legislation, but there was not one single penny of financing for it. So I think any Republican who voted for that legislation has no right of any kind whatsoever to say a critical word about Obama's legislation.
David Cutler joining us from Harvard. I suspect that's music to your ears, what Bruce Bartlett was just saying. But a lot of people do have a lot of concerns about exactly what Bruce was pointing out there, that the financing of this big overhaul. Christina Romer is quoted this morning, of course, President Obama's chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, is quoted in the New York Times this morning saying this is the most significant act we could take to tackle the deficit. How so, David?
Well, I think Bruce is right, and I think your quotation is exactly right in two senses. The first one is that we have a very severe long-run deficit problem in the United States that is driven to a huge extent, not entirely, but almost entirely, by healthcare costs. So unless we get healthcare costs under control, we will never address the long-term budget, and these bills try to do that. And I think second, these are important because I don't see any path to sustained economic growth in this country that does not involve healthcare reform. There's almost nothing more important than figuring out how we're going to provide people security and lower the costs that businesses, individuals, governments pay. And we have to address that, or else we'll never have a real economic growth that works for the middle class.
But David, the big question that people have about this healthcare reform, and I think unlike in 1993-94, there is now general consensus, as you say, that we do have to reform the healthcare system. But the big question people have about both these bills is, are they doing enough to cut costs?
That is correct. That is exactly the fundamental issue. And there are different views about how to do it. The way that I see it, the most important thing we can do, what we have to do is restructure, modernize the healthcare system so that it focuses on providing us better care and it does so cheaply. And the bills all do that to varying extents. Now, I personally think some of them are better than others. I think the Senate bill probably does a bit more than the House bill and so on. But they're all focused on that. What I think these bills do is they provide a pathway that we can use to go to do this. So they lay out the foundations, the information foundations, the payment foundations, the changes in public sector foundations. We then have to follow that up. We being government, we being individuals, we being medical care providers, have to follow that up to make sure that we actually take advantage of what's in there so that 10, 15 years from now, we really truly have created a better healthcare system, not just one that's piling on more of the same.
Norm, are you satisfied that the bills are doing as much as they could to cut costs?
No, I'm not, Catty, although I think they are doing some things. Getting to what David said, he's right that the biggest drivers by far, overwhelmingly, of long-term debt and deficits, healthcare costs. That is, first and foremost, Medicare and Medicaid. And then it also includes all the cost shifting that goes from those programs to the larger
system.
Norm,
talk me through the numbers a bit on Medicare and Medicaid, because we've heard a lot about the train wreck that's coming here.
Well, what we have now is that Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security are just over 8% of our gross domestic product. If we don't do anything to change things, they're going to be over 20% and moving towards 30% of the GDP by the time we get to 2030, 2040, 2050.
And this is all because of the aging population.
Well, it's not just the aging population. It's that healthcare costs are rising much faster than other inflationary costs. Let me just say that on Medicare, I believe the single most significant thing that we could do, which is in one of the bills, is to create an independent panel that does not respond to the daily congressional pressures to keep expanding benefits or play games, that would begin to restructure the incentives in the Medicare program. If that's not done and we keep the basic system as it is. And here, by the way, Republicans are offering no help because perversely they've taken a position that they want to protect every dime of Medicare now and on into the future just to oppose these plans. But that's really necessary. On Medicaid, we're expanding Medicaid significantly, pushing some of those costs off onto states that can't really afford it. But the biggest component of Medicaid is long-term care. And what I fear a little bit is one of the proposals on the table is to move towards a private insurance, long-term care insurance, which is going to reduce deficits in the short run, but it clearly causes them to explode because it's not paid for adequately over the long run. So we have to be very careful there, and we have to be sure that we don't change Medicare and Medicaid in a way that they just push those costs onto the other parts of the healthcare system. And there's a lot in this bill that would keep that from happening.
Bruce, to what extent is it also the sort of looming problem that we have with Medicare and Medicaid is up against the fact that we have the lowest tax revenues in the country in decades? So you've got this kind of chasm between high Medicare and Medicaid costs and low tax revenues.
That's right. Very few people seem to realize how low taxes are. We finished the fiscal year that just ended on September 30 with revenues at 14.9% of GDP versus a post-war average of about 18%. You have to go back to the year 1950 to find a year in which revenues were lower than they were last year. And it's for this reason that I think that people who continue to claim that tax cuts were the one and only thing that would have gotten us out of the economic crisis are simply insane. There's simply no evidence of any kind whatsoever to support that position. Now, on the healthcare, when we talk about the cost, there's a tendency to talk in terms of net costs, whereas the gross cost is whatever, $800 to $1 trillion, depending on what numbers you see. And this is paid for it through a cobbled together financing mechanism that involves some cuts in Medicare Advantage, some soak the rich policies on the income tax, and some excise taxes on insurance companies. I think this is a very, very bad system. I think they should have come out with a dedicated financing mechanism that was dedicated to this particular plan in exactly the same way that Social Security has a payroll tax that finances Social Security and rises more or less with the cost of that program. I fear that a lot of these savings are not going to emerge, that down the road there'll be changes made in the tax system that will take away some of the revenues, and you'll be left with yet another program that is more or less financed out of general revenues. So I think that it would have made a lot more sense, as many people suggested, that we put in something like a value-added tax and use that revenue dedicate it to the health system. In fact, we could have folded the whole Medicare system into that, gotten rid of the Medicare tax, and had a much more stable health care financing system. And if people understood that the VAT that they're paying at the checkout is paying for their health, and if that rate and if health spending goes up, that tax rate's going to go up, they would have an incentive to hold down costs, and you could have used the spending to offset the regressivity of the tax. It was a system that would have worked very, very well, at least on paper.
David, would that ever have been politically possible? And one element that seems to be missing to me from the healthcare debate here is the idea that there is going to be any pain in this, that we are going, that in order to bring down deficits, reform the healthcare system, it seems to me inevitable that something's going to have to give at some point. You're either going to have a dedicated tax, as Bruce is talking about. You're going to have some kind of controls in healthcare spending. And yet nobody, it seems to me, from the administration right through Congress, is prepared to mention that. You compare that to the leader of the Conservative Party in Britain, David Cameron, who's talking about the fact that there is going to have to be some sort of pain in the short term, at least, if we're going to improve our welfare state in Britain.
Well, here's what we know about healthcare. One of the things we know is that probably up to about a third of all the money spent in healthcare is not doing much good in terms of improving patient outcomes. We know that by comparing the U.S. to other countries. We know that by comparing high-spending areas in the U.S. to low-spending areas. We know that by looking directly at the care that people receive in different circumstances. And so it's sort of universally agreed that kind of technically we should be able to take out 20-30% of healthcare spending while at the same time improving quality. Let me give you a couple of
examples. Wait a minute, David, we are going to have to go to a break. I want you to hold on to that thought, because this is a very interesting discussion about how much we are going to have to give in this system. David Cutler is joining me from Harvard. Bruce Bartlett and Norm Ornstein are here in the studio with me. We are discussing the healthcare reform plans and their impact on the economy. Stay listening. Welcome back. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC. We are discussing America's healthcare reform plans and the impact that they are going to have on our economy. With me in the studio, Norman Ornstein, Bruce Bartlett, and I'm joined on the phone by David Cutler from Harvard. We'll be taking your calls in just a moment, 1-800-433-8850. And the email address, of course, is drshow@wmu.org. David, I apologize. We had to go to a break and you were in the middle of a thought about what we can save in the existing system.
Yes, thank you. So most everybody believes we can save 20 or 30% or more in spending. The real issue is how to do that. And it's going to require a lot of hard work. So if you just look at some of the examples, there are people who get infections in hospitals because, for example, doctors didn't wash their hands regularly enough. That's something we ought to be able to eliminate. There are people who get tests that haven't been shown to contribute to care at all, but it's reimbursed well. There are people who don't receive good preventive care and thus wind up with more expensive conditions and they wind up costing more. The question is, are we doing enough there? And this, I think, where all of us were in some agreement, which is that we have to push on every possible margin we can to try and take advantage of those efficiency savings. I personally think the bills have a number of very good elements in them about that. When you say, well,
enough to make the kinds of savings that we really need?
I think they really do lay the foundation for that. But partly there are different ways of looking at it. So some people really believe, as your question implied, that the only way we will do this is by, in essence, outright rationing, saying to some people you can have this and other people you can't. That's not where I would say most of the kind of academic or policy-ish work is. Where a lot of that is really around the idea that if we get the system set up the right way with the right information and the right incentives, we can really take advantage of huge efficiency savings. Now, to be fair, there are people who feel scared by that. There are a lot of providers, there are a number of patients, there are people who are saying, is this really going to work for me and will it work well? And the best we have to say is, look, we need to try this. And if this doesn't work, then we'll have to do something else. But this is where the bulk of the opinion is about how we can really save money while simultaneously improving quality.
Okay, David laid out there why he thinks the system is so expensive and unaffordable. I want to know if you all agree. Can we reach a conclusion on why the American healthcare system is as expensive as it is, Norm?
I do think that David is right that the magic word is incentives. One problem we have here is that we've got 17% of our GDP. We've got roughly 17% of our workforce, most of them smart and well-educated, who are getting money out of this. And if you cut something out, you can say it's magic and it's efficiency, but somebody is going to get less money and is going to try to find a way to shift those costs to somebody else. So we do have to work on incentives. It's incentives for physicians not to order too many tests because that's the way they can get reimbursed or because they're afraid of getting sued. It's incentives to insurance companies to try and cut their expenses and administrative costs. It's incentives to patients to behave better, to be less obese, to smoke less, to exercise more, to get preventive care, and to seek out better insurance and not waste a lot of money in the process. Doing that easily is not possible. Doing it in our culture, where we're not going to pay medical providers at the same rates that some other countries do to reduce their costs, or even that we're going to get people to agree that they'll wait 6 weeks for an unnecessary procedure, not a critical CAT scan. That's not what we're used to. So this is a painful process, and that's one reason why we're getting a lot of pushback from people as they approach the edge of actually incurring that change, even though they don't like the costs that they have now or in many cases the insurance they're getting.
Bruce, do you agree with the cost diagnosis?
Well, it goes without saying that we could cut our costs very substantially as a share of GDP because there are lots and lots of other countries that have health care quality, health care outcomes that are not substantially different from ours, and they pay half as much of GDP as we do. England, for example, a country you're familiar with, pays 8 or 9% of GDP for a universal health care system, and nobody pays anything. That's all you pay. We pay twice that much, and what do we get? I don't think that the longevity in the United States is significantly greater, infant mortality, on any general measure of the health of society, they're not doing so badly in Britain. And what are we getting for another 8 or 9% of GDP equivalent to what we pay for the income tax? What are we getting? We're not getting anything, really.
Right. Now, that argument has been made. It's clearly not going to fly in America. I mean, you're not going to have the kind of health care system.
But we're already paying 8 or 9% of GDP for health right now from the government. Between Medicare and Medicaid, we're spending as much as Britain is spending, plus we're spending the same amount on top out of our pockets, and all we're covering are the elderly and the very poor, and you've got a huge swath of people in the middle who either have gold-plated medical care through their employer because they're working in a heavily unionized industry or something, or they don't get anything. Clearly, there's a lot of unfairness in our system that could be improved in some way or another. But I should mention one thing that got this debate off on the wrong track is when the decision was made right at the very beginning of this debate that we weren't going to touch the exclusion for employer-provided health insurance. It was decided by both Obama and by Congress. We're not going to touch the 800-pound gorilla in the room that has led, more than anything else, to us having this irrational system.
Okay, I want to read an email that's come in here from Lynn in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Lynn asks, why should our tax dollars be spent to subsidize health insurance companies? They are the reason we see such huge administrative waste. Why should our healthcare dollars be diverted to high CEO salaries, shareholder profits, marketing and advertising, plus the $1.4 million a day health insurance companies are spending on lobbying Congress? Administrative costs for traditional Medicare run about 3%. Study after study shows that an expanded, improved Medicare single-payer system will save us money and will provide medically necessary care for all, Norm.
Well, it's certainly the case that we have a British-type system here in the United States. It's called the Veterans Administration. We have a Canadian-type single-payer system that uses private physicians and hospitals and the like, and that is the Medicare system. So we have those things, and there are certainly administrative savings. At the same time, we've got flaws in those programs, and perhaps if the administration had started out saying, we want to expand Medicare for large numbers of people, it would have been easier than talking about a public plan. But without doing that, or without saying that we're going to do the kind of thing that Bruce talked about, which is really to begin to transform a system that was built with no rhyme, reason, or purpose, having employers be the intermediaries here, and then having no incentives for reducing costs because it's all tax-free to people, if we're not going to start down that path, then we're going to have private insurers involved. We're going to get some of the questions that Lynn raised about where they're going to be, and we're still going to have them be a critical part of the system. We're going to have a mixed public-private system that isn't going to work very well. Public-private systems can work well. France is a good example. Switzerland may be even a better example. You can have private insurance companies in a regulated marketplace and make it work better. But somehow we're a long ways away from even beginning to graft something like that onto what we've got.
But in those countries that have a mix of private and public where it works, well, Japan and Germany are other examples, the insurance industries are very heavily regulated and they can't make big profits. David, is that an option for America? Could it happen here? Would it be advisable?
I think a lot of the spirit of what's happening is people get very afraid by big changes in healthcare. Healthcare is very personal to them, and they don't want it to see it upended. What the strategy that the president and Congress are following is to say, not let's automatically tear down what's there, even though in many ways we believe it is the wrong way, but rather let's build something first that works, and then once that works, see about how to transition people over to it. And the debate that you're engaging in, or the issue that you're engaging in, is really about that. It's about, should we say, look, we believe there's something better, so let's move there rapidly, or should we say, let's first build something that works? I think over time, there may be very many more changes that can happen. For example, if we set up insurance exchanges and they work well, and those are the right way, that's the right way for people to get insurance, maybe then we'll come back and think about the broader tax exclusion. Or if we set up a public option and it turns out that people really just love insurance from the public sector because it's got low administrative costs, then great, we'll have learned that. Or if it turns out people hate it, they don't like it, and they'd really rather be in a private insurance plan, we'll learn that too. So what we need to do is set something up, figure out what works, and then come back and say, how do we modify what's there? Otherwise, it just looks far too frightening to people.
Right. So, David, you're close to the administration. Are you suggesting that we are wrong to fixate on this idea that this is our definitive chance at healthcare reform, and that actually what you're talking about is a more piecemeal approach? And actually, we've seen in the past in America, I mean, you take civil rights reform here. I mean, clearly that was a series of bills. Are you suggesting that this is going to be the same, that actually we're at the beginning of the process and this may be one bill that is passed, but that there will be others to follow?
In fact, that's the way we do everything. When, for a long time, in the 1960s and 1970s, there were very, very few tax changes. And then the Reagan tax cuts in the early 1980s changed taxes, and then it's become a kind of, not annual, but every few years we go back and we revisit it. Welfare reform was the same way. There were a series of steps leading up involving big changes and then other changes that followed from them. So I don't think there's only one bite at the apple here. I think we're going to have to keep going. And just to come back to something that Norm Ornstein said, which I think was exactly right, the more we can get a lot of the technical changes out of the legislative process and into the administrative or into other kinds of processes, the better off we'll be. As we need legislation for big things, we need expert opinion and technical expertise for other things.
Norm, are there any examples of anywhere in the system where costs are coming down that we could learn from?
Well, we do have some examples. It's not clear that they're perfect examples, but we know that there are some healthcare systems, like Kaiser Permanente on the West Coast, Intermountain Healthcare in Utah, and a couple of other places. We also know from the experiences of the Cleveland Clinic and the Mayo Clinic that there are ways of building a better system. Frankly, I think one of the best examples that we learn from that is that if you bring physicians in and put them on salaries, generous salaries, take them away from being independent small business people where they have to make their money by individual services and away from the fee-for-service tradition, that you provide the incentives to move towards preventive care, to spend more time with patients, and to get better outcomes. That's a difficult move as well. Let me say, Katie, that I think David is exactly right. Everything that we've done, Medicare is another example of it. You start with a step, and then you make adjustments. This is not the definitive move, whatever is in this bill. We are going to adjust to it because everybody in the system is going to have to make some of those adjustments. The big mistake would be not acting now, doing nothing, and letting the system go on as it is, which at some point becomes unsustainable, and it will add to our costs even more than what we're likely to do now, especially if we are able to make some adjustments to build in some of those proper incentives down the road.
I'm Katty Kay of the BBC. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850 and send us those emails to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go to the phones now to Sal in Cleveland, Ohio. Sal, thanks for joining The Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Basically, I just have a question, is that why is nobody addressing the fact that the correlated rise in health costs is directly related to the rise in unhealthiness in the country, which is propounded by, you know, fast food industries, tobacco industries, pollution. So I'm wondering why the government isn't mandating regulations on industries so they can have some kind of domino effect to make people healthier, which in turn would, you know, decrease the health cost in general. I mean, America is, in fact, a very unhealthy country, and it isn't just, you know, a personal choice to be unhealthy. It has a lot to do with industries that perpetuate unhealthiness. So I'm wondering why the EPA, the FDA, the ATF are not, you know, working with the government to regulate some kind of regulations on these industries.
Okay, Sal, let me put your question to Bruce Bartlett. And actually, it's interesting because we have another question also talking, another caller who's asking about how the government could do more to tell people to stay healthier, basically.
Well, of course, we do regulate those things. We have extremely high taxes on cigarettes. Cigarette smoking has dropped dramatically. We have a huge environmental protection agency responsible for doing all those things. But I think trying to tie those directly to the health care reform debate is just, you know, mixing apples and oranges. I think you have to deal with the hospitals and the doctors and the insurance and companies, you know, as a separate issue from this other question of how we make people, you know, more healthy by, I don't know, putting taxes on sodas and things of that sort that I think are not really very viable.
Norm.
It was interesting to read yesterday that Michelle Obama is going to start to take on childhood obesity as one of her major issues, and I think that's extraordinarily encouraging. We know that chronic diseases driven by obesity, including diabetes, are a huge part of the costs that we pay, just as dealing with the final few months of life where we spend more and we take heroic measures to keep people alive longer, which have generated this debate about death panels, are indicators here. Finding ways to reduce obesity, and that probably has to come not through government regulation, which is not necessarily going to work beyond taxing things, but through moral suasion and even in some healthcare plans. You've probably read what the Safeway, which has its own health system, has done and others have to incentivize people to behave better because they're going to have to pay more for their health costs if they don't. And it's made a real difference. There are things that can be done there, and it's a critical element of this.
So you think it is possible to change behavior? We can do it.
It's. I don't think we are going to reduce our cultural desire to supersize or eliminate it. But I think you can gradually begin to move things through changing incentives through the insurance process, through opinion leaders like the president and the first lady, through taxing some of these elements. I was driving in a cab yesterday, and the cab driver said, "I quit smoking." Well, I said, "Well, that's great. It's very unhealthy." He said, "After 22 years, no, it just got to be too expensive." So at least to some degree, there are people who are affected by the costs.
Let's go to Mary in Surfside, Florida. Mary, you've joined the program. Mary,
hello?
Are you with us? Yes, you're on the air.
Yes, yes, I am. I listen to the show every morning, and I just want to know, why isn't anybody addressing reform the insurance industry? For those of us that go and buy insurance, which I do, and I just went through an experience where I had a baby, the insurance companies are robbing us. They take your money month after month. They make you meet these insane deductibles.
Okay.
And at the end of the day, when you've done that also, they don't pay.
Mary, so I'm going to have to interrupt you right there. We're going to take a break, and we're going to put that question to our panel when we come back to Bruce Bartlett, Norm Ornstein, and David Cutler. Please stay with us for our discussion on healthcare reform.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org, by the Gruber Family Foundation to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
A mystery and a love story rolled into one. The author of The Time Traveller's Wife returns with a new novel set near a famous London cemetery. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined our conversation with Norma Ornstein. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Bruce Bartlett is a former Reagan economic policy aide. David Cutler was a senior advisor to the Obama campaign. They're all joining me for our discussion on healthcare. Just before we went to break, we heard from Mary, David Cutler, on the stringent conditions that insurance companies are placing on people. Do the bills that are in the Senate and the House address those issues sufficiently?
I believe that they do. There are a number of new restrictions on insurance companies that come in these bills, basically making it, if not impossible, extremely hard for insurance companies to select who they want to insure and to turn people down and so on. Some people believe that the insurance companies will find ways around them, and if they do, then we'll have to come back and reconsider it. Other people believe that those provisions are enough. In Massachusetts, we have many of them, and it hasn't turned out to be such a big problem. But the other answer for people like Mary, who really have an aversion to private health insurance, is to say, look, they ought to have a choice of a public insurance plan if that's what they want. And at its heart, the debate over the public option strikes me as a little bit strange, that you have conservatives who are usually in favor of giving people choice arguing against giving people choice on this. I don't think it's the be-all and end-all issue in reform, but I do think it's, for a lot of people, it's very important. They just don't want to be in a setting where they're forced into a private policy and they don't trust those providers.
Norm, I've got an email here from Melissa in Fairfax who writes to us, and I haven't personally checked these figures, but we think that they are correct. Health premiums have soared up by 131% for family coverage from 1999 to 2009, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. Considering our incomes went up 0.03%, how are we supposed to keep paying for this?
And the answer is it's unsustainable the way that things have been going. And we also know that insurers have indicated that premiums are going to go up another 20% in the next year for a lot of people. In many cases, what's happened here is that employers who have borne the brunt of this directly, at least, have adjusted their plans. And that's made it harder for people like Mary because you end up with higher deductibles and you end up with insurers trying to find ways to trim their costs. But we're not going to be able to sustain that. One question is whether what we have in these bills will be able to reduce health inflation at least to the level of other inflation or something close to it. It's going to be tricky because, as you noted earlier, we have an aging population and there are going to be more problems involved there. But if we can't do that, then the debt bomb that we have is going to explode even earlier than before. And hopefully there will be some things here, including changing the incentives, that can reduce some of the waste and alter the system to make some of Mary's problems with the insurance industry at least reduced. And there is much in the bill, as David said, much in these bills that I think will make it a little bit better.
Bruce, I just want to read you something, talking of the debt bomb that Robert Samuelson wrote this morning in the Post. He writes, "The correct conclusion to draw is not that major governments such as Japan and the United States can easily borrow as much as they want. It is that they can easily borrow as much as they want until confidence that they can do so evaporates. And we don't know when, how, or whether that may happen."
Well, as the late Herb Stein always used to say, trends that can't continue don't. But I think almost everybody who looks at the budget feels that we've sustained an unsustainable trend longer than we thought was going to be the case. But I think it's important to remember that one reason markets have reacted rather benignly to the unprecedented deficits we've seen over the past year is because they believe they're temporary. And if they came to believe that we were going to be running deficits of this size year after year after year, I think you'd have an enormous sea change in sentiment that would cause interest rates to rise very substantially and to a point where at some point down the road, I mean, I'm old enough to remember I once got a mortgage for 12% and considered myself lucky. If we get back to those kinds of days, which we had in the late 70s, early 80s, there will be a political pressure on to do some painful things that are right now people are not willing to accept, such as significantly higher taxes, cuts in programs that they like, including Medicare.
I remember talking to a doctor in Nashville, Tennessee last year who said to me, this healthcare debate is actually a cultural debate, that it really is about trying to reform a culture where people think they should have everything they want and have it right away, and that's a very difficult change to bring about.
Well, that's right. It may be that in some place like Britain, where there was because of the rationing during the war, you had queuing, people kind of got used to kind of waiting in line for stuff in a way that we didn't do here. And so that forms part of the culture of why the public health service in Britain is extraordinarily popular with every political party, and how people react with horror at the thought of having to wait a few minutes in a waiting room to see their doctor here.
Norm?
You know, the part of our problem is that we've been able to get government services at a very healthy discount for a long period of time. And now it's become clear, after years in which the Republicans ran everything, that for both parties, what the public has said is, we want services provided at a level that's 20, 22, 23, 24% of GDP, and it'll probably go up because of the health issues. And if we keep revenues at 15% of GDP, it is unsustainable. Once we decide what level of government there is a consensus about, And it's easy to demagogue it and talk about how you're going to cut waste or you're going to cut unnecessary things, which amount to a fraction of what the real costs are. Then you've got to figure out how you're going to pay for it. And we're not there yet. And I'm afraid our dysfunctional political system with no taxes, more tax cuts, even as we keep protecting programs and increasing government, could lead us to that problem that Samuelson talked about if we're not careful.
Well, let's talk about the dysfunctional political system. Here's a tweet that's just come in. One of the issues, of course, during the campaign that both John McCain and Barack Obama agreed on was the need to improve technology in the healthcare system. Here's a tweet that's come in asking, most technology, especially electronic, gets cheaper. Why do markets have no effect on medical technology? It stays expensive, David Cutler.
It's a very good question. We do have occasions where it does get cheaper, but then when it gets cheaper, we use it so much more. So an example would be, say, when we develop a new kind of surgery that's cheaper than the old old kind or a new kind of implant, and then doctors decide, gee, since it's so much cheaper and less difficult for a person to use, why don't we use it more? But most fundamentally, the question is, why is healthcare not as productive as other industries are? And that's really about use of information. I am struck when I look at healthcare that it is the industry, the industry in the economy that uses information the most, and it is the least technologically intensive industry of any.
How so?
Well, most people's medical records are still on paper. So if one doctor wants to know what another doctor thought about something, they have no way of doing it except by asking you to carry the paper back and forth. The number of people who are given medications that they're allergic to because the list of what they're allergic to is on a paper and not there at the right time is staggering. Or the list of people who get, or the number of people who get discharged from a hospital said, you know what, you need some outpatient care. Their doctor never knows about it. They have a difficult time making an appointment. They wind up never seeing a doctor, not taking their medications, and they're back in the hospital 3 weeks later.
But how does that affect costs?
Oh, in each of those cases, it affects costs greatly. In the first case, the doctor redoes the procedures because the results from the first time aren't around. In the second case, instead of taking a 20-cent-a-day pill, the person's back in the hospital with a $4,000 or $5,000 visit because they weren't able to see anybody. We know, come back to the model health plans, we know that in the Kaisers, in the Mayo Clinics, in the Geisingers, in the Intermountains, they spend a lot of time coordinating things. Whenever a person leaves one provider setting or one provider and goes to a different setting or a different provider, they make sure that that information goes. And that's partly why they're able to save an enormous amount on these very expensive cases.
Okay, let's go back to the phones to Bob in Morristown, New Jersey. Bob, thank you for waiting. I know you've been waiting on the line for a while. You've joined the program.
Well, thank you very much. Just a real quick comment on the last comment. I can't tell you how many times I've gone to a new doctor. He says, well, we take our own tests here, and then later found out that the tests were done at exactly the same lab that the old doctor used. I mean, there's no, you know, it's
a classic case of too many tests being done and the costs rising again.
Exactly. But I have to fault the media in this whole debate to a large extent. You open the program by saying this is going to cost $889 billion or something along those lines. Well, that's a 10-year cost. A more accurate portrayal would be to tell people what it's going to cost in terms of an increase in the annual budget of the United States and also what it's going to cost individuals. And those are numbers that are easily attainable through the Congressional Budget Office, and they don't account for any savings that are going to come in because of administrative efficiency. So it just blows the whole thing. Nobody knows. You can walk down the street, ask 100 people to define what a billion is, and 98 of them aren't going to have a clue. I mean, it's just a number. And the bigger the number, the scarier the number.
Right. I think actually, Bob, I think you've got a very good point there. But I mean, most people, myself included, get very confused between the number of zeros after a trillion and zeros after a billion. And once we get into these astronomical figures, whether it's to do with the stimulus or to do with healthcare reform, I think people, it's very confusing. It's very hard to actually put a number on this. But Bruce Bartlett, Bob's point about the fact that we are not really making an honest assessment or a clear assessment to people of how much that is going to cost, this is actually going to cost people individually less than is being portrayed.
Well, I don't think it's true to say that they've made no estimates of efficiency gains. I think they have. The problem is it's very hard to estimate those. But going in the other direction is that every single program that we've ever implemented for some health, for such as Medicare, has always ended up costing vastly more than we estimated when we created those programs. And so I think it's reasonable to assume that no matter how hard they try to estimate these costs accurately and pay for them properly, you know, 10 years from now, the costs are going to be vastly higher than they were estimated, and the revenues or the savings that they're using to pay for them are going to be much less than they're estimating. And I'm not blaming anybody for dishonesty here. That's just the way it works.
Let me just add another point of context. If you look at what the United States will spend on health care over the next 10 years total, I don't have an exact figure in front of me from the projections, but it's probably over $40 trillion. We're spending, you know, close to $3 trillion a year now. So we're talking about 1/40th of what we would spend on healthcare to begin to transform a system to include a lot of people under the insurance rubric who haven't had it before, to give people a little peace of mind that if they lose their jobs, they're going to have something better, to maybe create a better system of competition, to change towards more preventive care and away from unnecessary testing. But in that context, it's a pretty small sum of money to invest in this if we accomplish some of those goals. $1 trillion sounds like a huge amount, and it is, as it adds to our deficit problems, which are already very deep. But in the larger sense, it's a tiny drop in the ocean to begin to transform a huge system that is bulky and overgrown and badly needs change.
Can I just jump in on one quick point?
Yep, go ahead.
The last three major changes in Medicare, the Congressional Budget Office has, in every single case, overstated the cost and understated the revenues. It was true in the drug benefit. It was true.
There were no revenues for the drug benefit.
No, I know, but whenever there were revenues. It was true in the drug benefit. It was true in the Balanced Budget Act of 97, and it was true with prospective payment in the 80s. I think that, but what this comes down to, and it comes back to points that Bruce made, what's really going to be crucial here is how much we wind up changing the system. And if we change the system for the good, it will have an enormously bigger impact than what is in the official estimates.
Yeah, but what if we change it for the bad?
And if we don't change it for the good, then it could wind up costing more than we think. And the real issue is going to be how much does this lead to a real change in the nature of the healthcare system versus how much is this kind of nibbling along the margins.
I'm Katty Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please call 1-800-433. Send us that email to drshow@wmu.org. Bruce, are you suggesting that the system as it is, as you look at the bills that are in the Senate, you look at the bills that are in the House, you look at the political influences from both sides and the lobbying that's going on from the insurance industry and other concerned factors, are you concerned that we end up with a bill that actually makes the system worse?
Well, from a financial point of view, I think that's probably baked in the cake. Whether health outcomes are enough better off to justify that cost, I don't know. But I do think some of the discussion about this health plan is a little Pollyannish in that it's assuming the best possible outcome in every case and not looking at the range of options that are out there. Things could turn out to be a lot worse. And when you're using long-term budget projections, it's reasonable to have that range of projections. And maybe the midpoint is the reasonable one to assume. But if we had a competent opposition party in this country, it would be pointing that out. But instead, the opposition party says we should do nothing. Our health plan system works perfectly. It should be changed in no way whatsoever for any reason.
Okay, we've just got a minute or so left on the program. Norm, I just want to look forward. What's the schedule now going forward in both the House and the Senate? What are you expecting over the next few weeks?
I think we're moving towards trying to get bills through the House and Senate before the end of November. The House probably acting more quickly than the Senate. The Senate still has some work to do to put its bills together and a conference committee. And it would be surprising if we didn't have a bill that was ready for the president's signature, assuming we get there and the odds remain better than even that we will until shortly before Christmas.
And you've talked about this as just a first step, but is it a big first step? Is it the right first step? Are we on the way to really reforming the
system
in a way that Bruce
would like? Until we see the final package, we're not entirely sure. But I think there are a lot of positive elements here that we can build on. So I'd be more comfortable having this happen. I wish we could build in some of the things, constructive ideas that Republicans had. But by being non-players, many of them will be left out. But I think we're moving.
And of course, the Republicans are going to be presenting their own plan.
We could do better, for example, on malpractice and defensive medicine if we incorporated some ideas, if we got some Republican votes in return for them. But I think I hope we're heading with a cautious move in what I hope will be the right direction.
Good to end on a positive note. Norm Ornstein is resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Bruce Bartlett has been with me as well. He's a columnist and former Reagan economic policy aide. David Cutler has joined us on the phone from Harvard. He was a senior advisor to the Obama 2008 presidential campaign. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
I'm Katie Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thank you so much for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.